everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's June 2022, and this is episode 290, which is a conversation about literature and a Darwinian worldview. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Louis Marcos, who holds the Robert H. Ray Chair in Humanities at Houston Baptist University. He is the author of more than 22 books, including his recently released book, From Plato to Christ. Lou has written a feature article for our print edition, volume 45, number 1 of the Christian Research Journal, and his article is called Just So Science. And you can read his article if you're a subscriber or when you subscribe to our journal, and you can do so at our website, equip.org. Now, I have been mentioning the last few episodes that we are having a very special promotion for Christian Research Journal subscriptions as a way to celebrate the end of our fiscal year and have people partner with our ministry at the Christian Research Institute. So for the month of June, we are continuing that special promotion. One subscription for your gift of $30 or more, and a subscription's retail value is $33.50. You can get two subscriptions for a gift of $55 or more, three subscriptions for a gift of $75 or more, and four subscriptions for a gift of $100 or more. That is a great value, because with that gift of $100 or more, you'll also receive one copy each of two hardcover books that have are collections of the best of the Christian Research Journal articles. One is called What is Truth? And the other one is called Whose Ethics, Whose Morals? So you get two books plus four subscriptions. So we invite you to partner with us and help us at the Christian Research Journal grow our subscriber base. So now back to the podcast. Lou, it's good to have you on.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
Well, as I mentioned, we're talking about the feature article that Lou has written for us called Just So Science. And one of the things that he references in his article are the Just So stories of Rudyard Kipling. Now, not everybody knows or is familiar with who he is. Maybe, I guess, if you're a Disney fan, you might be, you know, familiar with one of his works that was made into a Disney film, but in terms of the Jungle Book. But what are the Just So stories of Rudyard Kipling? Because they seem to be not as known as his other works. And how are they specifically relevant to evolution, which is what we're going to be talking about today?
Great. Rudyard Kipling, again, author of the Jungle Book, wrote a book called Just So Stories. That used to be one of those books that everybody read to their kids, but it wasn't even read to me. It's kind of a little bit older. But the whole idea is there. Just So Stories means, how did the elephant get its tusk? It's tusk. How did the camel get its hump? How did the leopard get its spots? There are all these cute little stories that he tells children, making up reasons for why these animals have these odd shapes and these odd appendages. And it's a lot of fun. And today, people still use the word just so story to mean, okay, you're coming up with a tall tale to explain something odd in nature. Well, I would argue that most of evolution is a just so story. And Melanie, it drives me crazy, because the thing is, a lot of people think that Darwinian evolution is most powerful because of its science. I would argue it's most powerful because of imagination. A child can look at animals and say, oh, look, this looks like this, and this looks like this, and maybe this, you know, change to that, this change. Of course, it's all nonsense scientifically. It doesn't work. I'm sorry, macroevolution doesn't work. But we can see it, and we can imagine. I often compare it to the transporter in Star Trek. Most people are familiar with that. The idea is, you step in the transporter, this ray hits you, and it turns your body into, you know, millions of atoms. Then it sends those atoms across space, and another machine reassembles those atoms, and now you're somewhere else. Again, I can imagine that. It's really cool, but it's complete nonsense. You're going to turn your brain into atoms and bring it back and be the same person? It's nonsense, but it has an imaginative power. So the just so story is, we see something in nature and say, oh, I wonder if this caused this. And again, I don't really think it's logical, but it has imaginative strength.
Well, you mentioned various different thinkers in your essay, and three that you mention are David Hume, Aldous Huxley, and Richard Dawkins. And I don't know if all of our listeners are familiar with those three particular people, but I would first like you to explain who they are and ask you, are they inconsistent on issues like morality, determinism, and design? Because, for example, Richard Dawkins is more contemporary, and he is very much held up by those people who are atheists or agnostic who would say he really has a lot to say when it comes to critiquing Christianity and very much defending evolution.
See, I would say that all three of these great thinkers are telling just so stories because they say something and then immediately they contradict themselves. So, and David Hume is from the 18th century. Actually, Huxley, I wasn't thinking of Aldous Huxley, the author of Brave New World, but his grandfather was T.H. Huxley. He was a Victorian, and T.H. Huxley was also often known as Darwin's bulldog. He was a contemporary of Charles Darwin, and he's the one that really popularized his theories. And that, so he's from the 19th century, the Victorian age. And then Richard Dawkins is an example of a new atheist from the 20th century and, of course, the 21st century. Now, David Hume has a very high reputation for being a philosopher and a thinker, and he claimed that he disproved miracles and all these things. But Hume coined this phrase, you can't get an ought out of an is. Now, what does that mean? Laws of nature are is, they're facts. This is this, this is that. But an ought is a moral precept. I want to do this thing, but I know that I oughtn't to do it and that I should do something else. Now, Hume knew well that you can't evolve a fact of nature, an is, into a moral obligation because nature knows nothing about moral obligations. And yet, even though he said that, Melanie, he still acted as if it's a good thing to be a good, virtuous person. So he's inconsistent. And it's funny because I've heard Christians quote that, you can't get an ought Evan is, but they often don't realize that that was said by essentially a new atheist of his day, and he was inconsistent. Now, this T.H. Huxley, he pushed forward Darwin. And I'm sorry, but if you're a Darwinian and you believe it's all this natural selection, then everything is deterministic. We have no free will. We have no volition. Just nature is doing its thing. Well, Huxley argued again and again that it's evolutionary, that it's naturalistic. And yet he keeps insisting again and again, but of course we still have free will. I'm not a determinist who think everything is determined by, you know, scientific formulas and things like that. So he was inconsistent as well. And then there's Richard Dawkins. Again and again in his books, he speaks as if there is design in nature. And then, you know, without fail, every chapter somewhere he says, now, of course, you know, I mean, it's only an appearance of design. And Melanie, I get frustrated with these people that use words like nature and chance to explain why things are the way they are. Nature and chance are actually nothing. They are not agents. Nature is what we call the natural world, but nature itself is not an agent that can do anything. So what I'm saying is these very intelligent thinkers say things and contradict themselves at the same time, and yet they cling to their just-so stories of this is how it happened.
In your article, you also mention Christian apologist C.S. Lewis and the fact that he taught that naturalism is self-refuting. What did Lewis mean by that?
Lewis wrote a wonderful book called Miracles. Now, most have read Mere Christianity. A lot have read The Problem of Pain. Miracles is a little bit less known, and it's a little more difficult, but I think it's essential reading. Now, when we say naturalism, we mean the idea that all there is nature. There is no super nature. Lewis puts it this way, for a naturalist, nature is the whole show. It is a closed system. Well, guess what? Naturalism propounds certain theories about nature. This is the way that nature is. But Melanie, the only way that you can make statements about nature is if you can step outside of nature and study it. But if naturalism is true, There is nothing outside of nature. There is no supernatural, metaphysical standpoint from which we can study nature, because we are just as much a part of it as a fish or a dog or a monkey. Also, a little bit deeper, why naturalism is self-refuting. Well, naturalism as a science is based on us using our reason. But if naturalism is true, then there is no reason why we should be able to trust our reason, because it's just something that evolved randomly. So naturalism itself sort of unpacks or explodes itself because it cannot account for the very rationality on which it is based. It's a wonderfully simple argument. And it was reiterated by, Alvin Plantinga wrote a book about where the real conflict is between science and religion. And he kind of repeats it, puts it in a little more philosophical terms, but it's basically the argument that Lewis made.
I want to tell you about a very special promotion that we're having to grow the subscriptions of the Christian Research Journal and get our magazine into more people's hands for Christians to be equipped, as we say in the tagline on our print edition, to be equipped in exercising truth and experiencing life. So we give you all kinds of articles that help you with Christian apologetics and doctrinal discernment, as well as articles that will help you grow in your faith and help you understand your union with Christ even more, including this subject that we're talking about today, about what it means to become older and what the Bible has to say about aging from a biblical perspective. And so here's how you can get a subscription, help us for our fiscal year end, and also to maybe give some subscriptions to friends, your pastor, or family members. And so if you go to this link, equip.org/product/journal offer, that's one word, journal offer, you will go to this landing page that will tell you that you can get a subscription for a gift to the ministry of $30 or more. And normally a subscription, as I mentioned on this podcast, is $33.50. You can get two subscriptions for a gift of $55 or more, three subscriptions for a gift of $75 or more, or four subscriptions for a gift of $100 or more. And you would receive two hardcover books, one copy each from the vault of the Best of the Christian Research Journal. And so we have a book called What is Truth? And another book that's called Whose Ethics, Whose Morals. So for a gift of $100 or more to the Christian Research Institute, you will get four subscriptions and two hardcover books. Plus, all of the subscriptions, as you know, include access to our online exclusive articles that you hear me mention a lot on this podcast. So you would get all the online exclusive articles as well as the print subscription right to your door. So please consider giving a gift to help us for our fiscal year end, as well as spreading out the information for the Christian Research Journal to family and friends, and maybe even church staff members that you attend. It's a really great equipping gift. And so again, the URL is equip.org/product/journal offer. Well, one thing I wanted to ask you about was another well-known literary figure, and that's G.K. Chesterton. And I'm wondering how he, in specific, you talk about him helping to unravel the myth of the hominid. Now, I do want to tell our listeners, if you're newer to this podcast and you've missed more recent episodes, back on episode 277, I have a really in-deep dive with Fuzz Rana from Reasons to Believe, and we talk about who was Adam, and we get into various different things about Homo sapiens, sapiens, etc. So if you want to hear a very scientific discussion about it, I would refer you to our recent episode 277, but this is more of talking about someone who is a literary writer, G.K. Chesterton. So how did he in particular help, you know, unravel that myth of the hominid?
Good. You know, to me, one of the greatest creations of science fiction is this so-called caveman hominid, this ape-like creature who is hominid, in other words, shaped like a man, a human shape, but is still a great ape. We need to understand that that was almost invented by H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells was also essentially a new atheist of his day. He's best known for writing The Time Machine and War of the Worlds and other things. But what a lot of people don't know today is he's really famous because about 100 years ago, he wrote a book called The Outline of History, a sort of history of the world. And he spends the first several chapters talking about this so-called caveman as one of our ancestors who is hominid, but not human. And Chesterton, writing about that time, about 100 years ago, in a book called The Everlasting Man, a book that had a profound impact on C.S. Lewis and leading into the faith, in that he talks about this so-called caveman. And he says, what evidence do we have for the caveman? And one of the evidences that's still put forth today, and I'm sure, Melanie, you know about those famous cave drawings in those caves. I think they're in France, Lascaux or something in France. And there's other places. And there are these amazing cave drawings of animals and reindeer and something that looks almost like a buffalo. And they're simple, but they're very full of life and movement. And so people say, well, there is a caveman. There is a primitive artist. And Chesterton says, that is not a primitive artist. That is an artist using primitive tools. Those cave drawings are as much art as Michelangelo's David. It's just that the tools being used are primitive. But whoever made those works of art, those cave drawings, are fully human. As Chesterton explains, an ape or a monkey does not create art. A monkey does not begin to create art. A monkey does not begin to create art. Once you have art, you have made a leap. The difference between the smartest ape and the most ignorant human being is not a quantitative difference. It's not like a little more, and then boom, you got a man. It is qualitative. It's a leap. Chesterton says, it's not an evolution. It's a revolution. One thing I love about Chesterton is about 100 years ago, he said, people keep telling me, of course, man evolved from ape. What about the missing link? And Chesterton reminded them, it's called the missing link because it's missing. It doesn't exist, right? So there's a lot of, I think, a lot of humor here. But we need to understand that what little evidence we have, they are human. They are not some kind of ape man or hominid that, you know, is lower on the evolutionary scale. They're just as human as we are.
So one thing that you mentioned is that you think the evolutionary paradigm is flawed when it comes to the progress of civilization. How so? Because those who, you know, like Dawkins, who hold to evolution, and he's also an atheist, would refute you on that, would say, you know, that's just been part of how everything is possessed. It's just gone a lot faster more recently than the actual, you know, billions and billions of years to even have the first human being.
It is a good point. And see, we need to understand that evolution in our modern age, since the 19th century, evolution is not just a theory of origins of, you know, animals and humans and whatnot. Evolution has become a complete worldview. So people today believe that everything evolves. People have just taken for granted that we all began as animists running around, right? And then we evolved to pantheism and then polytheism and then monotheism and then science. A lot of the more recent studies are showing that, no, it looks like there is some original primitive monotheism and we fell away. And by the way, that's what the Bible says. We all began as monotheists and we fell away into polytheism and pantheism. And there's a great, great book called Eternity in Their Hearts by the late Don Richardson, who went around and found very primitive groups that everybody thought were animist, but they still had a full memory of monotheism, but they'd fallen away from it and were frightened by the spirits and things like that. So we need to get away from this idea that evolution explains everything. Again, we have this idea that we've gone from sort of barbarism to humanism. But really, the oldest civilizations we know of, Egypt and Babylon, are highly civilized. Sometimes they're also highly corrupt, but they're highly civilized. The best way I can put this that just refutes all of this, all right, let's say the moment my son was born, I took him to a Stone Age tribe somewhere in the middle of Africa. And in that tribe, there was a leader who also had a son. And we switched our baby sons at 1 week old. And then I raised that tribal boy like my own, and the chief raised my boy as his own. Guess what? That boy would grow up as a fully modern person, knowing everything a modern person does, and my son would grow up as a primitive person, knowing very, very little. So again, we take this for granted. It's a just so story. We just have taken for granted that that's the nature of things. But things, I mean, maybe technology evolves, but even then we seem to have lost the technology used to make the pyramids and even the pyramids in our side of the world, the Mayan pyramids and things like that, or Machu Picchu down in Peru. So we've got to break out of this paradigm that has never been proven and that is really refuted by what we know about human civilization. It rises and falls and back and forth, and it's not a simple linear progression.
So one thing is that there are various different new atheist thinkers. We mentioned one in this podcast already, which is Richard Dawkins. Of course, there's Sam Harris and the late Christopher Hitchens. And I also want to tell our listeners, before we talk about this particular topic, because I'm going to ask you about racist implications of Darwinism, is that this month on our other podcast, Hank Unplugged, CRI President Hank Hanegraaff is going to be interviewing Richard Weikart, who wrote a book called Darwinian Racism, How Darwinism Influenced Hitler, Nazism, and White Nationalism. That's a 90-minute deep dive into the topic of Darwinian racism. But I still want to ask this question to Lou as well. So these various new atheist thinkers that I mentioned, you know, how are they inconsistent regarding the racist implications of Darwinism itself?
They are inconsistent, and thank the Lord that they are inconsistent, but not all people have been. If Darwin is true, then all the engine of life is, he called it natural selection. We sometimes say survival of the fittest. It's still the same thing, that the stronger survives and reproduces and passes down its genes. And Hitler was a disciple of Darwin, and you must understand, of course, Christians do not accept what Hitler did, but we need to understand that his concept of racial purity is pure Darwinism. If Darwin is right, then there are, first of all, Melanie, as you probably know, what is the often obscured subtitle of Darwin's Origin of Species? What is it? The struggle for life amongst favored races. People like to sort of elide that, we say, kind of cross it out to make us forget that there are specifically racist implications. Now, I don't believe Darwinism is true, but if Darwinism is true, then there were many people who believed that whites were more fully evolved than blacks, because blacks seemed to have more features that looked, whatever hominid-like. All this. Of course, this is nonsense. I don't believe this, and no Christian's going to believe it. But if Darwinism is true, and that is the element of life, it leads to racism. And it did lead to racism in Hitler. It did in the white supremacists. And very scary, it led to another kind of racism in Margaret Sanger, the founding mother of a Planned Parenthood. And it's kind of nice, Melanie, we're talking about this right now when there is that rumor, at least, that Roe versus Wade may be defeated. We don't know for sure yet, but that would be quite a triumph. But we need to understand that what Margaret Sanger was doing, it was about abortion, but it was really about eugenics. And she was happy to see what she saw as the inferior people, which often included people of color. She wanted them to breed less, and her, whatever, white upper class people to breed more. These are difficult things to talk about, Melanie, but these happened, and they came out of Darwinism. They did not come out of Christianity. Christianity are the people that stopped infanticide in the ancient world when they would take babies that were, weak and all, and they would just leave them to die of exposure. It was the Christians who believed that every life has inherent value and worth who fought for the lives of these castaway children. They basically invented orphanages to take care of those children. So we need to understand that Darwinism is not morally neutral. It comes with some very scary implications.
Now, I do want to ask you a little bit about Christians thinking through Jordan Peterson's theories without accepting Darwinism. And I say that because Jordan Peterson is a very polarizing and provocative internet personality, but why should a Christian think through some of the things that he's saying without accepting Darwinism?
Again, and that's a very important question, and I think it's St. Austin Review is going to publish a big article I've written on this, but I just mentioned in passing in this essay because I think it's so important. And that is, if you read his books, you know, his books about 12 Rules for Life and the sequel to it, Beyond Order, he does mention evolution all the time. Famously or infamously, in his very first chapter of 12 Rules for Life, he talks about lobsters and the evolution of lobsters and how they fight for dominance and whatnot. Now, this is what's important, because I've read through all of Jordan Peterson. And whenever he talks about evolution, the important stuff that he says about evolution that really connects organically to his points is always about microevolution, not about macroevolution. Look, macroevolution is adaptation. And that's what Darwin proved. All species have the ability to adapt to their environment and sometimes make micro changes to adapt to that, right? Well, that's no problem for a Christian, or shouldn't be, right? God made us each after our own kind, and God equipped every single animal with, and even plants, with adaptation strategies to protect them. Now, it just so happens that often we will find a similar adaptation strategy in ants or birds that we find in human beings. Sometimes it's really crazy because that adaptation strategy seems to disappear and all of a sudden come back with us. Well, guess what? God is a smart designer. He doesn't keep reinventing the wheel. He will often reuse adaptation strategies in very different species. So basically what I'm saying is, I don't think Christians need to be scared away from Jordan Peterson because he speaks of Darwin, because again, most of what he's, I would say all of what he's doing only necessitates microevolution or adaptation strategies to help us understand how we live and thrive. So I don't think that that is a defeater for a Christian to read and learn from Jordan Peterson.
One of the authors that you mention in your essay is an author named Christopher McDougall. Now, he wrote this book titled Natural Born Heroes, How a Daring Band of Misfits Mastered the Lost Secrets of Strength and Endurance. And in that work, McDougall admits that Darwin had a hard time accounting for altruism. So why is that exactly? Why, as humans, are we drawn to stories about sacrificial heroes?
This was a great fun book by Christopher McDougall, and it actually takes place in Crete, because in World War II, the Cretan people mounted this unbelievable defense against the Nazis and held them back. I mean, it's an amazing story how they did this. And McDougall is one of these modern authors that's really fun to read because he mixes together history with science, with health. Like, he talks about improving your diet and all that sort of stuff, but it's not this silly losing weight things you see on TV. It's really a well thought out and researched book. But he's drawn to these Cretan, you know, freedom fighters, resistance fighters, and a lot of them showed altruism. Now, altruism is when you basically risk your life, often for somebody that you don't even know. You might not even be related to them, but we do these amazing acts. And Darwin himself admitted, I can't understand altruism. Now, why is that? Because if Darwin is right, the engine of change, the engine of evolution, natural selection, says that nature selects the strongest, and those strongest breed and pass down their DNA so it can be passed down. So altruism doesn't make sense. Let's say I'm a 20-year-old man. I'm not married yet. I see a stranger in danger, and I put my life on the line. And by doing that, I risk dying. Now, if I die as an unmarried 20-year-old, I am not going to pass down my genes. It just doesn't make sense for Darwin. And again, people come with all these just so stories, really silly sort of stuff to explain why people do things, but it doesn't make sense. And at least Darwin was fair about that. And yet, here's the double thing. Not only do people risk their lives to be heroes, altruistic heroes, put everything on the line, like somebody who, you know, in the Vietnam War, I'm in a tent with all the army and somebody throws a live grenade and I throw myself on top of the grenade and take it and die so no one else dies. Why? These are not my brothers. These are not people. Why am I doing it? Okay. The amazing thing is not only, I think, can Darwin not explain why people do altruistic acts, I don't think he can explain why we are so moved by stories about heroes. Why are we attracted to those people and hold them up as role models? And maybe we don't have the courage to follow through what they did, but we recognize their courage. And again, we sort of idolize it in a good sense. We idolize it. So again, I don't think Darwin can account for that. And McDougall seems more or less a Darwinist. And he keeps saying, I can't account for it, but I'm going to account for it anything. I don't believe it, but I believe it. It's that same strange inconsistency. And again, Melanie, thank God they're inconsistent.
So why do you think that, you know, the physical adaptation strategies that we share with the animals, that, you know, those don't account for the moral choices that we make as humans?
McDougall has a lot of fun in it. And again, even if you're not into history, he talks about, it's a little beyond my pay grade here, but he talks about the fascia. And the fascia is like the whole network of ligaments that connects our bones and things like that. And if we learn how to run and exercise from our fascia, we can do a lot of amazing things that you see some of the animals do. We can bounce around from rock to rock and leaping here and there. And it's all sorts of fun. I think it was the first of the new James Bond movies, Casino Royale, where these people are jumping from one place to another and all that sort of stuff. Parkour, it's called. I've never seen that word before. But he talks about it. So it's really exciting to read about this. But when he shows this, right, and that we have some of this strength that animals have if we only learn how to access it, he thinks that somehow proves evolution, right? But look, again, just because we share certain elements with animals, there is still an element to us as human beings that transcends any animal, right? So we might have some of the same abilities through training. We might have some of the same abilities to leap here and there and everywhere. But still, we, unlike animals, make the moral choice or decision of what to do with that strength. We all remember that famous line from Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility, right? And that's not true for animals, but human beings. So yes, we are part of the animal kingdom. We were created out of the dust. Okay, we share those elements, but there is something in the, you know, one of the first things I taught my kids when they were reaching puberty is, look, the difference between us and animals is when animals go into heat, they must procreate, okay? Well, humans go into heat, especially teenagers, but we don't have to give in to that base passion. We can choose when and when not to use our sexuality, just as we can choose when and when not to use the power inherent in our physical structures. Again, these are qualitative differences, not just quantitative ones.
So, you know, what's the difference actually between the chemical composition of DNA and the information that's in it? I mean, is any of that related to, you know, issues of altruism? Because evolution, you know, people who hold to evolution would say that, yes, we don't need religion to make good moral choices or to be altruistic. We can, as atheists, you know, do better, be better humans, know how to treat people and be altruistic.
In the essay, Melanie, I try to use an analogy to help us understand against the difference between quantitative and qualitative, between an evolution and a revolution. What is the difference? Okay. The DNA, there's kind of two parts to the DNA. There is the chemical composition of the DNA, what the DNA is made up chemically. Now, first of all, I don't believe that could evolve, but let's just say it could. Okay, I still don't think it could. It's too complex. But let's say somebody found a physical natural process by which the DNA strand itself could evolve. Well, guess what? Even if they could come up with that mechanism, they still can't explain the fact that that chemical DNA is front-loaded with more information than a supercomputer. Right? There's a difference between the DNA strand itself and the information that is loaded upon it. The DNA strand is natural. The information is ultimately supernatural. Nature doesn't create information. Evolution cannot create new information. Heck, even when we use breeding to change cats and dogs and things, we can only ultimately make that dog weaker. We can't create more DNA. You can't evolve a Chihuahua into a Great Dane. You might be able to go the other way around with human breeding. But again, we've got to understand the difference between mind and matter, matter and mind, brain and consciousness. And so, again, even though we share some chemical composition with the animal kingdom, there is an information in us, a consciousness, a conscience, a moral accountability that transcends nature and that nature knows nothing about.
You know, I would like you to tell us a little bit about one of his examples about heroism, because you note that in your article that he questions the survival of the Cretan resistance. And I would like you to share that with our listeners. And how does this response in particular argue against Darwinism? So like, what does real heroism look like?
Let's talk about this. And let's end, because I put down a quote for myself from McDougall's book, where he spent the whole book trying to understand heroism and resistance fighting and altruism, right? And as in any well-written book, it's sort of coming to a climax where he, the author, has his aha moment. Now I think I can understand heroism and altruism. And he talks to a Cretan resistance fighter. This is a long time later. Remember, the Cretan resistance is in the 40s. So he's talking to a man that's, I think, 90 years old, one of the last people left, McDougall. And he asks him, how did you do this? How could you act so altruistically? And these are the words he quotes from this man. The man said, when you live in a place like this, small by itself, you're brought up to give help, not wait for it. When your neighbor needs something, he needs you, the person he knows, not the army, not the police, you. And if you're not there, someday you'll have to look him in the face and explain. All right. I love how he builds up. That's kind of like the climax of the book. And I guess he forgets that he believes that all of this evolved. Because when I read this, this is uniquely human. This is passing down a legacy of what it means to be human. This is something that once again transcends the natural realm, that is uniquely and specifically human, that calls for people that are moral, ethical creatures, volitional creatures, people who know everything about ought, whereas nature knows only is. So I'm glad he leads up to that, but I don't think he understands that this ultimately works against his thesis and points towards, and again, it points towards theism, but I would say that it does point towards Christianity, because it doesn't just point to a God who is impersonal. It points to a personal, loving God in whose image we are made. So maybe it could point to Judaism as well, but ultimately this is the kind of revelation we get in the Bible of a loving God who has put those things in us as well.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. And on another note, finally, I have some fun rapid fire questions for Lou, and we ask these so our listeners and readers can get to know some of our authors better. So Lou, what is your favorite meal?
My favorite meal? Oh my, oh my. I was just eating fajitas the other day. I love those. That's we call it Mexican, but it's really Tex-Mex. But it's good stuff, especially with a lot of guacamole on it.
Well, it is almost June and it's time for graduation. So what graduation advice would you give to your 18-year-old self who's a senior in high school and about to graduate?
Wow. All right, I'm going to be a little deep here, but this really is important. One of the great lies that we're taught in higher education, both undergrad and graduate school, is the sign that you're becoming smarter and wiser and more intelligent is that you become more cynical and more skeptical and are able to see through everything. That is an absolute lie. Cynicism and skepticism is the death of wisdom. Wisdom begins with wonder, with awe, with gratitude and with humility. So please, when you go off to college, don't let it turn you into a self-righteous, smug person who thinks you're now above everything and can look down on everybody. Be in a position of a true student who wants to have their eyes open to greater knowledge and greater wisdom and also greater virtue.
Wow, that's very philosophical and great advice for our graduating students, whether they be in college or in high school. Well, thanks, Lou, for being a guest once again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Well, it's great to be back on. Say hello and say hello to Hank.
You've been listening to episode 290 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Dr. Louis Marcos, who has written a feature article in our print issue, volume 45, number 1. His article is called Just So Science, and our subscribers can read it. And if you're not already a subscriber to our print edition, which includes the extra value of having access to all of our online exclusive articles, please go to our website, equip.org. And for this month in June, please partner with us as we wrap up our fiscal year and receive a subscription or get multiple subscriptions for very special offers. So go over on to equip.org and partner with us at the Christian Research Institute.